The Jericho Network on Westwood One.
Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second.
It's your last chance to get great holiday savings at Guitar Center. Like a Yamaha F335 acoustic guitar, just $99. Or get a Luna Soprano ukulele, only $49. Plus the newest and hottest guitars, drums, keys, and more. Exclusive gear you can't get anywhere else. Special financing. Lessons for the beginner on your list. And gift cards, the perfect present for every musician. So hurry in and find your sound at Guitar Center.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to the Pod of Thunder and Rock and Roll. It is Friday, and here we go with the Duff McKagan joke of the week.
The dad was washing his car with his son, and the son said, "Hey, Dad, next time, can we use a sponge?" Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, Duff McKagan. Yes, what a groaner as usual. What we've come to expect here on the Duff McKagan Joke of the Week. So cool for Duff to call in and leave those little gems every once in a while. Today, on a serious note, it's been 20 years to the day almost that the wrestling world lost Brian Pillman, the late great Brian Pillman. So I went and talked to my friend Dave Meltzer at the Wrestling Observer, who was a good friend with Brian Pillman. I wanted to go back and reflect on the life and times of this very interesting and unique individual. Dave became really good friends with Brian over the years and started covering his career almost from Brian's first days at Stampede Wrestling. So today we're going to talk about how Brian got into wrestling, his run at WCW, the Hollywood Blondes tag team with Steve Austin, the loose cannon gimmick, and how Brian ultimately used that loose cannon gimmick to get his release from WCW, and then negotiating and eventually signing with Vince McMahon and WWE in one of the craziest double cross swerves of all time. You're not going to believe the story if you're not familiar with it. We'll also talk about some of his great matches and the days leading up to his death. Dave Meltzer talking about Brian Pillman coming up today on Talk is Jericho, 20 years after he passed away. But before we get to that, Fozzie's been having a blast on the road with Gemini Syndrome and The Stir. The shows have been awesome. The crowds have been great. The biggest tickets we've ever sold in the States on this tour. It's been so much fun, and we're winding down. A few more dates before we head to Europe. Tonight, we're at the World Live at the Queen in Wilmington, Delaware. Come check us out tomorrow night on Saturday, October 7th, Jacksonville, North Carolina, at the Tar Heel Opry House. That's going to be a good one. Then we finish up this short run on October 8th in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, at Johnny and June's Ultra Saloon. Come check us out. It's a great rock and roll package. And then, like I said, the Judas Rising Tour is going all the way to Europe, starting October 27th in Birmingham, England. And then we go to Dublin, Belfast, Halloween in Chester, Manchester, London, Sheffield, Glasgow, Newcastle, Amsterdam. Then we go to Aschaffenburg, Germany on the 8th, Pratteln, Switzerland, head over to Italy for Roncade, Rome, Trezzo, and then Vienna is on the 14th, Munich, Essen, Hamburg, Genk. Get your tickets at FozzyRock.com and also be a part of the best VIP package in the business. You will get to hang out with us. You get to see us rock and roll. We play a mini concert for you where we do songs that we're not going to hear anywhere else. I think we did Quiet Riot, Metal Health, and we did TNT last night, Cold Gin. We do a lot of those type of tunes. Lots of fun. And the new Fozzy record comes out October 13th, just 1 week away. Here is the second song on the album and the second song you hear when you come see us live. This is the critically acclaimed kick-ass rocker, Drinking with Jesus, right here on Talk is Jericho.
Drowned in the holy water at the bottom of the trenches.
Taking me low, I'm a flame from the bottle of sex. Get in me close, you're the only one that's left that can heal my pain. No one but us, my friend, my loss, all alone. all alone, and I'm drinking with Jesus.
That's Drinking with Jesus, the new one from Fozzy. It's going to be on the Judas album, which is coming out next Friday, October 13th. We are just 1 week away, like I said. And thanks to everyone who's already reserved their cabin for Chris Jericho's Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea. Wow, we've already made quite a few sales. It's been great. And remember, it's happening next October. Not this October, not in 2 weeks. Next October, 2018. Lineup is stacked. Go to ChrisJerichoCruise.com for all information or subscribe to Talk is Jericho at Apple Podcasts so you can be the first to know who else is joining the Rager at Sea. So far, Master of Ceremonies, Chris Jericho, hosted by Jim Ross, about to announce the co-host, his illustrious co-host this week. We got Mick Foley doing comedy. We got Raven doing comedy. We got Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, Rey Mysterio, Lance Storm, and today's guest, Cyrus from Killing the Town. The Keeping It 100 crew is going to be there. Conan, Disco Inferno, Shane Helms. Also, Beyond the Darkness, Tim Dennis and Dave Schrader going to be scaring the pants off of you doing some live paranormal ghost story hours type of thing. Busted Open's going to be there. De La Greca, lots of the good cats. And also on the bill, Fozzy, Phil Campbell and the Bastard Sons, King, The Dives, The Dave Spivak Project. That's right, Spiwi's bringing his brand of rock and roll to the cruise. Jim Brewer's Loud and Rowdy, the best female AC/DC tribute band in the world, Shoot to Thrill, the best Ozzy Osbourne tribute band in the world, Blizzard of Ozzy's going to be there. And of course, the Pièce de Résistance, the coup de grace, Ring of Honor, presenting the Sea of Honor tournament aboard the ship. Matches happening in the middle of the ocean on a ring on the pool deck. We had to have an engineer come in and make it stable, make it sturdy. And the best part of it is this. Okay, let me tell you, when you hear who's going to be representing Ring of Honor on the Jericho cruise, it's going to blow your mind. This is not Saturday afternoon opening match job, guys. These are the top of the top, the creme de la creme. And remember, most importantly of all, the winner of the Sea of Honor tournament gets a title shot, a future title shot for the ROH World Heavyweight Championship. So there's a lot at stake here. And you can get all the information at ChrisJerichoCruise.com. You can even reserve your room for as low as $150. You can make a $150 deposit, and that's going to hold your spot. ChrisJerichoCruise.com, ChrisJerichoCruise.com. Don't wait. It's going to be amazing. The first 400 cabins booked get an exclusive Q&A with Chris Jericho. And if you book by January 15th, I believe it is, you get to take a picture with me and the list. All right. Lots more to go. Lots of fun stuff coming up. Dave Meltzer coming up to talk about Brian Pillman. And one of the reasons why Dave and I were able to sit down face to face is because of all the great Talk is Jericho sponsors, including TrueCar. That's right. If you're in the market for a new or used vehicle, there's only one thing you need. That's TrueCar. TrueCar made my car buying experience quick and easy, just like they promised. They also saved me a ton of cashola, and TrueCar can do the same for you. With TrueCar, you get upfront pricing information so you can enjoy a better car buying experience. And when I say upfront pricing, I'm talking about real pricing on actual inventory in stock at the local TrueCar certified dealer of your Schwazen. Using TrueCar lets you see what other people paid for the car you want, so you can determine a fair price and feel confident when you buy your car. Now, TrueCar connects you with a local certified dealer of your Schwazen who will honor your guaranteed savings, which makes your car buying process quicker and easier. And TrueCar also shows all the dealers available incentives before you arrive at the dealer. TrueCar users save on average over $3,000 off MSRP, and over 3 million cars have been sold to TrueCar users by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network. Over 13,000 dealers in TrueCar Certified Dealer Network, so there's definitely one near you. And TrueCar is great if you're looking for a used car. Over 700,000 pre-owned vehicles available at TrueCar Certified Dealers. So when you're ready to buy a new or used vehicle, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Do it now. Save time, save money, save peace of mind. Go to TrueCar. Remember, some features not available in all states.
Talk is hockey. Talk is Jericho.
All right. So you guys went and saw a movie this weekend in the theater.
Yeah.
Which did you go see?
It. It's your boy Scrambled Egg. We saw it.
Now, were you scared? Because I wanted you guys to go at first, and then you didn't know if you'd like it or not. So you watched the original It, which was a TV movie.
Yeah. So stupid.
It wasn't scary.
I was like,
In the movie, it was the one we went to see in theaters. It wasn't as scary as I thought.
Yeah.
But there was this one jump scare. Not really a jump scare, but there's one part where it's like they open the door.
No, don't say anything.
No, it's okay. There's no spoiler. Oh,
okay.
Answer, go ahead.
They open this door, and there was a girl there. She was hung up. Her hands were hung up with chains, and she had no legs. And it was so scary because it's like they didn't see her at first, but when they turned on the light, you could see her.
Oh.
And that was the one part that only scared me.
So tell us the basic plot of the movie.
All right. I got my explaining cap on. So basically there's this, but I just want to say something before I do explain. The Georgies in both of the movies, they looked really similar though.
Really?
Okay. Like, so, yeah.
Because this one was just about the kids, right? They didn't go back and forth.
Yeah. There's a chapter. It said at the end of the movie, it said It, chapter one.
There's
so
a
in 2019. Yeah.
Okay. So tell us a quick overview.
All right. So there's this creepy clown who lives in the sewers, and his name is Pennywise the Dancing Clown. He comes out every 27 years to feast on fear on kids or adults, but mostly kids. And this movie is about this time where these like group of kids, and it happens to them, and it like kills Bills. He's the main character, George's little brother, and like so they find the clown and try and kill it, and that's pretty much it. But it's really good.
What do you have to add to that? Because he changed himself into different.
Yeah, he changed himself into like fear. So like, let's say
if you're scared of werewolves.
Yeah, he turned to werewolf. If you're scared of like blood, he'll turn like he'll find somewhere where he could just throw blood on you. And if you're like if you're scared of. Since Bill, you see the original, and since Bill is like his fear is kind of Georgie, he turns into like Georgie all the time to scare Bill.
So Georgie's one of the characters.
Yeah, Georgie.
He's the bully, right?
No, Georgie's is the, he's Bill's
Henry
little
is
brother.
The bully.
Oh, Georgie's the one that gets taken into the sewer.
Yeah. But his death scene is so much better in this movie than the original one.
It's so sad because he's just there with his arm bitten off and he's like screaming like a banshee. But like there was this lady and she wouldn't help him.
But she didn't see him.
I know, but she saw him talking into the sewer and then she came out and she saw a bunch of blood and she didn't do anything.
She saw him looking in the sewer because, like, you know, some kids just randomly do that. Like, I've done that before, like, looked in, like, a grate or something. So she went back inside and when she came back out, there was this pool of, like, red stuff. And then that's when she ran inside and called 911.
She didn't call the police.
Yeah, she did, because she was the only one that saw and knew. The other people thought
she didn't tell the police. She didn't tell the police. Like then later when they
She told the police.
She did not tell the police.
Yes, she did.
She did not tell the police.
Okay, hold on. So let's
she
talk
did
about
not
okay,
tell
what was
the police.
Okay, let's go. So what was your who were your favorite characters in the movie?
Okay. I liked Richie a lot. Mm-hmm. There's this one line, like
Richie's the comedian.
Yeah, but he plays Finn Wolfhard in Stranger Things. But he had like they were in.
Oh, that's the kid from Stranger Things.
Yeah,
okay.
They called it gray water, where it's filled with like poop and pee and all that stuff. So they went into the sewer, and then he pulled up a stick, and then Eddie's like the germaphobe, so he didn't like it. And he's like, it doesn't smell like caca to me, senor. And that made me laugh really hard.
So that's your favorite?
Yeah, so that's our joke now. I really like Richie, and I like Beverly a lot. She's really pretty.
What's your favorite? Who's your favorite girl, Shai?
I liked Richie. Doesn't smell like caca. He's my favorite character because in this one scene, he said, like, he was walking into the house that where the clown was, and he was like, what was it? I forgot what he said, but he said something, like, really funny. Like, he saw it, and then he instantly regretted it, so he was like,
he felt bad for saying it.
There's a lot of, like, F-bombs and stuff. Yeah, so that kind of made it funny.
Oh,
so. when he looked around, he looked around and he was like,
F.
He was like, F. And then he was about to walk out, but then it was like, Richie, come on.
Yeah.
He went with them.
So what was your favorite scene from the movie?
Favorite
part?
Really liked the setup of Pennywise's like domain, like it's
his lair.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. It's kind of creepy. Like it's all the stuff that the killed kids have building them to a tower, and then above is like all the dead kids swirling around with like lost arms and legs and
gross.
Stuff. It's weird, but the setup is really cool. But my favorite that was my favorite like scene. But my favorite like part. Because we're like, they were in the house and then they saw all like the layer and stuff. And it goes into the well house and it was like Michael's old house that got burned and that's how his parents died. Mm. So it's like, it was a really cool setup and stuff. And the scene was funny. But my favorite line was, it doesn't smell like caca to me, senor.
What about you, Shai? What was your favorite scene?
So my favorite scene was probably like, my favorite scene was when they went and like, there was this one kid, he was part of like the bad guys, like
the bullies.
Yeah, the bullies, and he went into the sewers, and his fear was zombies, and he had like hairspray with the lighter, so when you spray it, it like flashes, and when he sprayed it, it like flat, and then he just saw, like, he thought it was the kids he was looking for, and when he saw all the zombies. He ran, but the zombies got him.
Oh,
and he couldn't get out of the sewer because that was Pennywise's trick. Because once he got into the sewer, he made it where it looked like an illusion, so he couldn't get out.
Oh.
But then my favorite scene. My favorite part was probably when, it captured Beverly, and when she was in the sewer trying to get out, it was like, introducing Pennywise the Dancing Clown, and he started doing this move with like ego.
It's like the Irish jig.
Yeah, the Irish, and then he like his face was like this while he was doing it.
He's real serious.
Yeah, it's like, and then as she was running, he kept doing it, and then he just bounced. It was so funny because he was like, he was doing it all serious, and then he just got like super serious and he just went. That was my favorite part.
So it was your first scary movie. Were you guys scared at all?
It wasn't that
scary. No.
Well, that's good.
I want to see, there's a new movie called Happy Death Day.
Oh.
And it's on October 13th on a Friday. But it looks really good and I really want to see that one.
So overall, what do you give the movie out of 10? Sierra?
Yum, yum, yum. Drum roll, please. I give it a 10 out of 10. No, a 9.99999.
Wow.
I didn't give it the 0.1 because it wasn't like that scary for me, but it was a really good movie and there were some jump scares. And it was
okay.
Good.
Shai?
It was good.
I give it like a 9.5 because it wasn't that scary. Like to you wouldn't think it was a scary movie at all.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, being a lot younger than you, no offense, but
how old are you guys?
A lot younger.
We're 25.
Bah.
And so,
how old are you really?
11.
Yeah. And well, that's so good. Like, your first.
It wasn't because it wasn't scary like as I thought it was. I thought it was gonna be a lot scarier. And the thing was, they did really good on like design stuff, but they, like, yeah, they could have just made it a lot more scarier than it should.
Than it should have been.
You'll think it's a good movie though.
What? Tell people about your vlogs before we go. Where can they find you?
Well, we're on YouTube.
www.ccandshyvlog/youtube.com
Or it's youtube.com/ccandshyvlogs So, but we haven't been posting for a couple weeks because we're working on a diss track to ourselves. Oh. It's called the Roast Yourself Challenge. But one will be up next or this Friday because we're making a Halloween series now where we have like a new Halloween intro and we're gonna make a Halloween
all
video.
All right.
Yep.
We'll have to check that out. All right, yeah. Everybody go check them out. CC and Shy's vlogs with a V.
It does smell like caca to me, senor. Goodbye.
Bye.
Hey, this is Chris Jericho inviting you to the first ever Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea. Picture this: rock and roll, wrestling, comedy, live podcasting, all on the open ocean from October 27th to the 31st, 2018, from Miami to Nassau. I'm bringing Hall of Fame wrestlers, some of the greatest rock and roll bands on the planet, and putting the first wrestling ring on a cruise ship ever. Don't be a stupid idiot. Make the list. Check us out at ChrisJerichoCruise.com.
Downsizing imagines what might happen if, as a solution to overpopulation, Norwegian scientists discover how to shrink humans to 5 inches tall and propose a 200-year global transition from big to small. People soon realize how much further money goes in a miniaturized world. And with the promise of a better life, everyman Paul Safronik and wife Audrey decide to abandon their stressed lives in Omaha in order to get small and move to a downsized community. A choice that triggers life-changing adventures. Starring Matt Damon, Christoph Waltz, Hong Chow, and Kristen Wiig. See the film Rolling Stone calls a visionary masterpiece, and Variety raves as a spectacular and ingenious comedy. Downsizing is in theaters December 22nd.
Talk is Jericho.
All right, so we are here with Dave Meltzer, which is the first time that we've ever done this in person. You've been on the phone a few times.
Right.
But in person, it was always a little bit better here in your hometown of in San Jose. And I had an idea a couple months ago. I went through this phase of watching Stampede Wrestling, where I hadn't seen it in years, and I found a guy who had them all on YouTube, mm-hmm. and I just started watching all the episodes, and just watching all my favorite guys, and Brian Pillman being one of them, and remember how much I loved Pillman, and just the whole concept of what Pillman did throughout his career, and I think he's almost a forgotten guy at this point in time, how good he really was.
It's 19 years.
Right.
19 years since he passed
since
away.
Since he passed away, right, yeah.
Right, as we're filming this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So, and I wanted to talk to you, because I know that you were fairly close with Pillman,
yeah.
and also the fact that you know kind of the whole story of his career and all that sort of thing, and because like I said, like he's such a complex performer in so many different ways.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the thing that is in this 19 years, there's really nobody that's come along like him. But the one guy who really reminds me of him now is Matt Hardy, in the sense of completely reinventing a character, being that character, you know, like all the time, and being kind of like this, you know, you don't really know how to take it, but when you really keep watching it over and over again, you go like, the guy's like really like kind of a genius mm-hmm. to pull this whole thing off.
Right.
And I mean, like with Pillman, like I didn't really like when he started doing it, I didn't really like at first it's like, what are you doing? I don't understand this at all.
Kind of this loose cannon character.
Right. Yeah. But, and he would come up with these, you know, the crazy ideas, you know, like the handcuffing himself to the ring post, to the goalpost of the Super Bowl.
No, let's talk about this bit. So Brian basically, and we'll talk about a little bit about before, but he basically reinvented himself as the loose cannon,
right?
Which was this character who would go off at any point in time, do all this really crazy, weird stuff, but nobody knew for sure if it was legit or if he was playing a character. He was that good at it, correct?
Right, and it was like the thing is like he would go. I mean, the story is really fascinating because he would let guys in, but he really didn't let anyone in the sense that when they were working everyone in WCW, you know, it was like him, Bischoff, and Sullivan. But at the same time, he was completely working Bischoff and Sullivan. Because, you know, like, I mean, he got a legitimate, he goes, to make this thing look real, you know, you got to give me a release. And it's like, okay, we'll give you a fake release. No, we got to fool the whole office. We got to fool everyone because no one's going to believe that you fired me unless all the paperwork's there. It'll get out. This is how it is these days. So they gave him like a legitimate release in the middle of his contract, and they started negotiating with Vince. And they were going like, it wasn't really, really a release. He goes, no, it's, I got a release. I'm, you know, so he started, because the whole idea was to get that release and bid the two sides against each other to get as much money as possible and to get, you know, in the best position possible. So it was like, but those were the guys who thought that they were like, we were the only ones in Brian's, like, you know, mm-hmm. And he was, you know, he was working everybody.
Right. When did you start to get to know Brian?
There's a guy named Kim Wood who was the strength coach of the Bengals, who was like Brian's father figure, because Brian's father died when he was young. And then when Brian went to the Bengals, they got really close because Brian was really interested in lifting. And Kim Wood was like, for that era, was like a real expert on all the lifting and all the history and things like that. And Kim Wood was a huge pro wrestling fan. I shouldn't say a huge pro wrestling fan, but he was a big enough fan that he read everything I wrote. And he was like a big supporter of mine from early on. And he was the guy who like got, you know, my stuff read all over the NFL, because it was like, you just got to read this stuff. It's whatever. But anyway, so he, when Brian's football career ended, and even before Brian's football career ended, he always, you know, he knew Brian's football career was only going to last a certain length of time.
Brian was obviously small for the NFL.
He was so small. Yeah, for his position and everything. But the whole thing is like, what's he going to do after football? And Kim thought, with his personality and look and everything, that he'd make a great pro wrestler. And as it turned out, by luck of the draw, he ended up playing with the Calgary Stampeders. So Kim was like, you're like in the perfect place to learn to be a pro wrestler, because they got wrestling in Calgary and it's the Hearts, you know. And so it was kind of like, you know, the Heart Dungeon, you know, all those stories, right?
Right, sure.
So that's where he got started. So I would say like right around the time he got started, like we kind of knew each other. And then as time went on in Stampede, you know, we got to know each other. You know, we would talk all the time. And then for the rest of his career until he died, we talked, you know, pretty regularly.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about Stampede in that era of like the mid-80s to late 80s, there were so many great performers there, because they were really starting to adapt, you know, I guess you would call it the junior heavyweight style, the cruiserweight style.
The Japanese thing.
It was more than that, though. Yeah, it was a real combination of Japanese, European, some lucha, and just the Canadian style, which is very hard-hitting. And Brian, along with Chris Benoit and Owen Hart and Beef Wellington and all those guys who are all passed away, incidentally, which is really weird, but they were all really great performers and kind of breaking the mold of what wrestling was. And Brian was so agile at that point in time.
Right. And the other one is Bruce Hart took a liking to Brian, mm-hmm. and made the tag team. And it was like, it was sort of like Bruce's Fountain of Youth, that he would team with Brian and play like the Rock and Roll Express type of gimmick, right? And everything.
Even though Bruce looked nothing like a rocker.
Yeah.
And Pillman had this good looking guy, long hair, and Bruce just, you could tell.
Yeah. But they like did that. And you know, Brian loved Bruce. I mean, it was like, because even like when he was doing the character, I would say that the guys that he really confided in the most were Bruce, Terry Funk, and Kim Wood, for sure.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So Bruce as well at that point?
Yeah. He was definitely, like, Bruce was definitely in on it and not being worked.
Hmm.
As best I could. I mean, I don't know, but I could tell from talking to Brian, like when he would go like, you know, just ask for different things. But it was like when he was coming up with his ideas, he would always, those would be the guys that he would pitch him to before he would do them. Sometimes he would pitch him to me, but I would always go like, that's too wacky. So, you know, he stopped pitching him to me. But, you know, because they're just so out of the box.
Sure.
Yeah.
But you knew right from the start, as soon as you saw Pillman on Stampede, that he was going to be going places.
I thought so. All those guys, like Owen Hart, you know, because they were just, you know, I mean, he had the right look, and he was... But
they're all good-looking guys, and they're all very agile, like you said.
And really good wrestlers.
Yeah.
In the sense of, you know, like... I thought... I mean, it was funny, because it was almost like... when I first started watching I watched the Stampede and the Bret Hart Dynamite Kid days too, but this was like the revival of it when I would like cover it pretty hard in the newsletter, and people would always go, why are you covering it? And I go, because these guys are all going to be something, you know. If you watched it, you know, you knew that like Owen Hart was going to be a big star.
Yeah.
And you know, so it was, yeah.
I think, you know, the first time I'd ever seen a lot of that stuff, and most of it was Owen doing this stuff I'd never seen, but the first guy I ever saw do a springboard was Pillman, Air Pillman, he called it, springboard clothesline. And I couldn't believe, like, oh my gosh, how do you do that? Like, you'd never seen that before.
Right.
You know, but he was, was he a fan of Lucha? Was Brian a tape watcher?
He was a tape watcher. He became, you know what, it was funny is, I don't think he was a fan of Lucha at the start, but he was a fan of the Japanese high flying, you know, the Jushin Liger and Tiger Mask and Dynamite Kid and those guys, because I think he saw at his size, these were the guys, you know, that were that was the way he was going to make it. He wasn't going to make it by like everybody else because of the size thing. Mm-hmm. But I know that a couple of years later, he got real interested in Lucha when he met with Conan. And the other thing that he told me was like he really wanted to go. I'd say in the early 90s, he wanted to go to Mexico real bad, probably around the time you were living there. Mm-hmm. And the reason it was like when he was in the United States, he was at this point, you know, he was kind of like in the middle of the card, you know, just a guy. And I think he saw that like if I could go to, but he was already in contract with WCW, but it was like, oh, if I could get a tour down there or something. I mean, he was so into, he wanted to be a main eventer so bad. And he thought like if I went down there, you know, size doesn't matter down there. And I'm good enough. I can be a main eventer in Mexico. And he just wanted to be a main eventer so bad. So that he started learning some Lucha when Conan came up. You know, a few moves off the ropes here and there. Because there was like a funny story where Conan and Pillman are like, Conan's kind of like teaching him how they do a few tricks. And Luger walks by and it's almost like, because this actually relates to Pillman years later. Luger walks by and kind of does like a kind of laugh, like, you know, like, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? And it, because that triggered him, because it was like Luger was making all this money and Luger was on top. And Pillman was like, he doesn't care. You know what I mean? And like, I care so much. And it was like, I want to make Lex Luger money. I want to be like Lex Luger. I want to be treated like a star like Lex Luger. Just, you know, to like, I don't want to say rub it in his face because that's too strong. But it was a motivating point. Because Luger laughed at him for trying to learn Lucha
Libre. It's funny, Dave, because Conan just told that story on his podcast the other day about...
Really?
Yeah, I don't know how it came to be, but basically Luger's like, oh, so now we got to do all this flying stuff now?
Yeah.
Like real sarcastic. And so that made Pillman mad at
Pistol. Right. Pillman got mad about like just the idea that he was kind of being mocked for trying to learn more.
Sure, right.
And more that it was coming from like a top guy who he didn't think... like it's like... you know, what's he got that I don't have other than he's, you know, six inches, 7 inches taller. But aside from that, Brian had a good physique just like Luger.
Yeah.
And Brian was a better worker than Luger. So it was kind of like, I got to find a way to, because even when, you know, when he was doing the negotiating back and forth, it was the word he would use to me was like, you know, I got to get a spot. The only way I'm going to make it in WCW is to get Luger money, because then if I get Luger money, they'll do what they do with Luger, which is they always keep him strong because they're paying him so much. They have to. Yeah. So he goes, as long as I can get like a Luger contract, they'll keep me strong. And Luger was the name that he would use always.
And it's interesting because that was WCW style. It didn't matter how good you were at that point in time. Whatever money you were making would decide how you got pushed.
Right.
So I remember even in my case, when I was there making $165,000 a year, I would never get to beat, you know, Stevie Ray or Scott Norton. Like, it just because they're making so much more money than me, it just financially wasn't feasible.
Well, just how they thought.
That's right. Yeah. That's how they thought. So Brian had that. Because wasn't there also a story, too, where he was signed and then, was it Jim Herd took over or Bill Watts took over?
Bill Watts took over.
And won.
So he was negotiating. This is when he was, I think, a light heavyweight champion. And Kip Fry was in charge. And Kip Fry was kind of like, hearing, oh, you know, you got to push light heavyweights. And he did that program with Liger, which was really, really great stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so it was his contract came due and he got $225,000 as a base, which was real high in that year in WCW, plus, you know, a bunch of bonus, you know, things worked in. So it was only, he was going to make like $275,000 the way we all figured it. And then Watts came in, and the first thing with Watts was they wanted to, you know, balance the budget, cut stuff. So he would see this guy who was like, and this is Bill Watts mentality, right? Bill comes in, it's 1993 or whatever year it is, 92, 93. And he looks and the two guys he saw, like that, who were the last two guys that Kip Fry signed for big money were Brian Pillman and Paul Heyman. And it was just like, no manager, you know, deserves $250,000 a year. You know, we got it. So he was trying to get rid of Paul for a cost cutting. And with Brian, he didn't really, you know, he kind of liked Brian in the sense that Brian was a real football player and a real athlete.
Right.
But it was like, no guy this size deserves this kind of a guarantee. So he went to Brian and it was just like, here's your options, which is like such bullshit. And it turned, and Brian was like, oh, this is like a real contentious situation. So he goes to Brian and goes, you got two options. You can, I can't make you give up your contract. You have this contract. So if you don't give up this contract, I'm going to beat you in the opener every single night. Okay. Until you're worthless. Or I'll push you as light heavyweight champion, but you got to take, you know, a lot less money, you know, 125 or 150. And Brian was just like, I'm going to be the, he remember him telling me right after the conversation, I'm going to be the highest paid jobber in the history of the business. He goes, I am not backing down. And everyone, like the Arn Andersons and all these guys, are going, just play ball with them, you'll be okay. And Brian was like, I'm not backing down. And I don't even remember, you know, he ended up being jobbed out for a while.
Completely, over right?
Yeah, they buried him until somebody came up with the idea of putting him with Austin, which, you know, Austin hated at first, although he ended up loving it later.
Talking about the Hollywood Blondes.
The Hollywood Blondes. And those guys were great. And the company, that was a real, Brian was so like into it. Like he's like, he would call me up and go, we got to get some tapes of Patterson and Stevens. I go, it doesn't exist. I go, like, there's nothing out there. And you know, he just wanted to, like, ideas of the great tag teams of the past.
So Steve didn't like the idea of getting put with Brian at first?
Well, Steve was like a, you know, U.S. champion, higher level
singles guy. Yeah.
Right. So at first he thought it was a demotion, but then that's how him and Brian ended up being, like, really good friends. So very quickly, I don't, you know, you have to ask Steve how
sure,
quickly.
Sure, sure, sure.
But they got along and they were really into it. And I mean, they were a really entertaining team. And then one day they had the big program. They worked with Steamboat and Shane Douglas, and then they were built for this big thing with Flair and guys, and Flair and Arn Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
But it was Flair's big return on the Clash, and it did. So they built it up for a couple months on TV with the Flair for the old and you know those talk show gimmicks with Fifi the maid and everything like that. And they had the match, and it was Flair's first match back after leaving WWF. And the match did a bad rating. I mean, a really bad rating. So, you know, they weren't going to blame Flair. They just spent a ton of money on him. So it was just like, these guys can't draw. And they, like, broke him up as a team. I remember when I heard about that, it's like, they're going to break you up as a team. I think Greg Gagne was the one who told Brian. But somebody did, like, you know, and they said, like, you didn't, you know, you couldn't draw on top. And it was like, and no one was drawing on top anyway at the time. But it was just like.
They blame them.
Yeah. They were. So they broke him up as a team, and then when they did that, so Steve got like a nice push as a single, and Brian was just completely forgotten again for a long time and kind of got depressed. I know he hurt his back, you know, doing the Stairmaster too much, and kind of got like at his term would be like, he like hid behind his tan was what he would say, because he was super tanned, but he said like, I'm really out of shape, but with the tan, I look okay type of a thing. And yeah. He was like, you know, be a little bit of a belly, but to him, it was like he was a fat slob in his mind, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you and I would think he looks great, right?
Right, but he's so used to being just completely shredded that any ounce of fat.
Right. So he did that, but it was in that, when he hurt his back was really the impetus for everything, because, you know, Brian had, he had the five kids, and his back was hurting, and his body was starting to hurt, and it's like, I can't do what I was doing before. I've got to reinvent myself. And that's where he goes, what am I going to do? And that's where he came up with this persona. That's really the impetus of it all.
So then what inspired the actual Loose Cannon character, Dave? I want to talk about that. But first, I want to say thanks to Geico, another amazing long-time Talk is Jericho sponsor. Listen, everybody's got a to-do list. Drop off the dry cleaning, pick up some milk, record the Talk is Jericho intro. But here's an idea. Let's save hundreds of dollars on car insurance. And the good thing is you don't have to drop off or pick up anything. All you got to do is go to geico.com, and in 15 minutes, you could be saving 15% or more on car insurance. Extra money in your pocket? It may just be the most rewarding to-do you do today.
Podcast One Sports presents Attack Each Day, the Harbaugh's podcast. Every Tuesday, you can hear Jack Harbaugh.
We're going to attack this day with an enthusiasm unknown to mankind.
Jim Harbaugh.
What the hell's going on around here?
And JT Rogan share their stories from on and off the field. Past guests include John Harbaugh, ESPN's Adam Schefter, and Pardon My Takes, PFT, and Big Cat. So don't miss an episode of Attack Each Day, the Harbaugh's podcast. Every Tuesday, exclusively on PodcastOne.com and the new Podcast One app. Just a sample of what's coming to Podcast One Sports.
Talk is Jericho.
What was his inspiration for the Loose Cannon? Do you have an idea? Did he just decide he's going to start being wacky? Or
I mean, you know, there was a little bit of a Bruiser Brody type of mentality in the sense of being an independent guy. But Bruiser Brody wasn't anything like that. I think it was just, I don't know. I can't say. I mean, it was like, you know, yeah, Bruiser Brody, Terry Funk a little bit, but it was
just basically just doing like, when you say Bruiser and Terry, they would just do whatever they felt, whatever off the cuff, walk into the crowd, throw chairs in the ring, whatever it may be. They had no rules on themselves.
Right. And I think Brian just wanted to do something different. And I mean, Brian was like, he would study wrestling, because I remember he read Luthez's book. Mm-hmm. Like in one weekend, and he would just talk to me forever about Luthez's book. And then he started calling Luthez and Stu. You know, he would call both of them. And, you know, like, it's like there'd be stories from like 1931, right? And Lou would have a version of the story, and then he calls Stu, and Stu would have a version of the story. And there's like differences in the story, because it's 1931, sure, right? And he'd go, who's telling the truth? Which one's a liar? And I go, like, it's 1931. I goes, who the hell knows?
Yeah.
And he would like call up Luthez and just go, you know, it didn't happen like this and everything. He was like crazy about like history and everything, but he was trying to find out something in history to
base the character off
to base his character off of. And I don't think there was anyone in history that he really based that character off of completely.
So how did it first start, the loose cannon character?
Just started getting wacky. That was pretty much it. I mean, I don't really, you know, just a little bit weirder and weirder. And
well, let's go through some of the main things that happened in with that character. I mean, I know there was the time with Heenan.
Yeah. So Heenan, I was there in Vegas. That was in Vegas. And, Brian swore to me, because I saw him like right afterwards, because I thought, oh my God, that's a work. You know, he grabs Heenan by the shoulders from behind. I think he was wrestling Eddie Guerrero in a match. And
Heenan's doing commentary.
Heenan's doing commentary, and Heenan walks off, and I think he may have like swore on the air or something.
What the fuck are you doing?
Right, right. So what happened was, Heenan, and I heard, talked to Heenan about this once. It was like Heenan didn't know what was happening, and he had the bad neck, and so he just freaked out. And Brian was like, and everything Brian was doing was a work. But Brian goes, I swear to God, that was not a work. We didn't plan that or anything. But it was like, you know, it ended up being another one of those things where everyone's going, is that a work? Is that not a work? And it actually, you know, fell into everything that Brian was trying to do, because he wanted everyone, you know, it's like wrestling's a work. People know it's a work. But I want them to believe that they don't know what I'm going to do and that, you know, I'm real. And he would play that character like all the time everywhere. I mean, even like in, you know, the Natby story with Vince McMahon?
No.
So this is another one I know. Okay, so this may have been that same weekend
in Vegas,
but it was definitely in Vegas. I think it was Vegas, but it was the Natby convention for sure. You had to be media to get in.
And so, Napty is kind of like all the syndicated shows are promoting their wares, basically.
Right, 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 right. And wrestling had a pretty big presence. And Vince McMahon was there with Jim Ross. So, we saw Joe Namath there. But anyway, so I'm coming out and I'm leaving, and he's walking in, you know, with this whole group of fans like around him signing autographs. And he goes, and he couldn't get in because he didn't have a badge, you know, because WCW didn't send him to be one of the guys. So I go, here, take mine. So he went in there. And then the next thing I hear, which is like, did you hear what Brian Pillman did to Vince McMahon? He runs up to Vince McMahon, doesn't know Vince McMahon at all. And he like hugs him like he's like, and making him like completely uncomfortable. And Jim Ross is there all embarrassed, trying to explain, he's just working. And Vince is just like, who is this guy? You know, like that. It was crazy.
He just wanted to make an impression with Vince?
He just wanted Vince to, you know, like, yeah, remember him. But also, I think he wanted to work Vince to where Vince wouldn't know if he was real or he wasn't.
Sure.
You know what I mean? He wanted Vince to be, because he figures like, if I can work Vince McMahon and get Vince McMahon going like, what is this guy? I can work anybody.
Then it could go. What was the Super Bowl one you're going to talk about before?
The Super Bowl. So this I think was an idea with Funk. So it's I just was, you know, before the show studying up on this, but it was 1996 Super Bowl. And he was, the idea that him and Funk came up with was at some point he would go to the game, and at some point during the game he would run onto the field and handcuff himself to the goalposts in the middle of the game. So it's like, you know, there's 100 million people watching. You know what I mean? And it's like, yeah, I'll get arrested for trespassing or whatever. I may have to pay a little bit of fine. But can you imagine the freaking publicity? Yeah. And I mean, the only reason he didn't do it was because he couldn't get a ticket to the Super Bowl.
Wow.
And he was trying to score a ticket to the Super Bowl from different people. But the thing is where he made his mistake was, when the people he was trying to score from, he told him what his idea was. And they were going like, if they trace that ticket to us, we're going to be in, you know how much crap we're going to get in? That it was like our ticket that got you doing the thing.
Right.
But yeah, he was absolutely, you know, it was him and Funk came up with that idea to do that for a publicity
100% stunt. Committed to this character is what he was doing.
24 hours a day, you know, like just always thinking of ideas. He would do talk shows in Cincinnati, one of the big right-wing talk show guys. He would call him up in character all the time, to the point where I guess it was so entertaining that when that guy would take a day off, he had Brian host the show, and Brian would be yelling at all the callers and acting all crazy. Yeah.
I remember I only met him one time, and it was my second week in WCW. Sorry, my second week in an ECW, his last. And I met up with him in the dressing room. We were in the Lost Battalion Hall in Queens, New York, I remember, and then the other show was at the ECW Arena. And he was really friendly to me. I think it's because the Stampede connection, probably the Benoit connection. But he, I remember him saying, if you really want to make it in this business, you got to do something that no one's ever done before. And a few hours later, he's running around looking for a belt, like a belt to hold your pants up, because he didn't have a belt. And he's asking everybody, hey, man, you got a spare belt? You got a spare belt? Someone must have a spare belt. Well, who carries a spare belt? And then he found a ball of twine and made a belt out of twine, like a hobo would, just walking around, like, look at my belt. I got this belt. And it was, wasn't like over the top crazy. It was just really awkward and weird. Like, what is this guy on? What is he doing? I remember, like, he just had this awkwardness to make other people feel that way. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that was what he was trying to do. You know?
Like, you weren't sure around him, but it was like you noticed him and you remembered him. Which was the whole key. Because, I mean, again, you know, you're talking about on a wrestling show where there's, you know, 20, 30, 40 characters on the television show, especially in those days. And it's just like, you know, how do you, you know, everyone's got a good body, everyone's good looking, everyone can wrestle to a certain degree, or a lot of guys can anyway, right? And it's like, so how do I stand out? And it was the whole thing is like, you know, how do I stand out in this crowd? And, you know, make something where I can make a lot of money to support my family for a long time with my character.
Right.
You know, I mean, that was the whole goal was just to get that Lex Luger contract.
Yeah, get the Lex Luger contract. Then the next night was in the arena, and I remember Taz had caned this guy, and the guy was bleeding, and so people were backstage tending to him, and Pillman is running around, call 911, call 911, someone call 911. And the guy was like bleeding, like, you know, like he had gigged himself. He wasn't dying. Yeah. He wasn't hurt. Pillman jumping up and down, call 911, call 911. And everyone was like, dude, calm down. I remember he looked over at me and winked. I'll never forget him winked at me. Like, it's all a work.
But I mean, but it's the only guys back there were the wrestlers, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
And for some reason, like I said, I'd never met him before, but I think because of that Calgary connection, he, you know, and I just remember jumping up and down, freaking out about this guy who basically had like a bug bite.
Yeah.
You know, and then he also asked me this, and I don't know if you ever heard this before. He said, we're doing this thing in WCW. It's going to be the new age Four Horsemen, like the Generation X Four Horsemen. And it's going to be Chris, Dean, might have been Eddie, one of those, Chris, Dean or Eddie, and Pillman. And he goes, what would you think about coming in as the fourth guy? And I remember he showed me the sign. It was a Four Horsemen sign, but with an X, like both arms crossed, holding up the two fours. And I was like, oh, gee, let me check my schedule.
Yeah, especially at that point in your career, right?
Nobody at the time.
Yeah.
And then I never saw him again, never heard anything more about it. But did you ever hear about a new age?
Oh, well, there's definitely a Four Horsemen versus Four Horsemen feud they were going to do.
Really?
Absolutely, 100%. No, he had told me all about that. Like, and he didn't tell me like it was going to be like Flair and Arn and these guys on the, because remember, he was in the Four Horsemen, it was Flair, Arn, Pillman, and I think Dean.
Or maybe Benoit.
Maybe Benoit.
It was Benoit.
Yeah, it was Benoit. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So Pillman and Benoit were going to break off from Flair and Arn, and there was going to be a like old Four Horsemen, new Four Horsemen thing. Where they were going to be the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. And he never told me who the other guys were going to be, but we definitely talked about, you know, the idea, and it was like that was like so big to him, the idea that, you know, he's going to be in, like Four Horsemen and feud with Flair and Arn.
Right.
You know, it was like, you know, that for him at that level, I mean, that was, you know, feuding with Ric Flair, you know,
in WCW.
Yeah, yeah. Right. It was yeah. So that was like huge for him.
But how did it just end up falling through? Or
man, he did the character, and then you know, he got released, and I don't know what happened exactly.
Let's talk about the Kevin Sullivan incident, because I heard about that. I was in Japan and everyone was talking about it, about how, you know, I respect you, Mr. Booker Man,
or right,
that sort of thing. What was the story behind that?
So I just remember, so I'm watching and Brian's all wacky, and they did, so there was something on Nitro where Kevin like takes Brian down and like goes for his eye, and I'm thinking like, and I'm getting worked by this one now too, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm going like, oh my God, he's got so much heat, Kevin, you know, Kevin's after him, like on live television, right? And you know, the announcers don't really talk about it, so you know what I mean? I'm like, I'm kind of concerned for him because about what's going on. And this, so I'll go with a backstory on this. Because this is what, because I hadn't heard from Brian in a couple of weeks at this point, and what happened was like he talked to Kim Wood, who was like his mentor, who came up with a lot of this stuff, and he goes, "What do I do about Because Kim Wood told me the story. He goes, what do I do about Dave? And he goes, you can't talk to Dave for a while. He goes, you just can't talk to him. He goes, don't lie to him, but you can't talk to him. So he was like avoiding me for a couple of weeks. So I'm calling and he's not getting back.
Because he didn't want you to talk about the about his angle? Or
No. He didn't. I think the idea was he didn't want to tell me that it was a work.
Okay.
But he didn't want to tell me that it was a shoot either, because then I would be pissed at him for lying to me, right?
Yeah.
So he's avoiding me. And then Kevin did a promo on it the next week on TV. And I go, Kevin did a promo on it. It's a work. Mm-hmm. So I kind of wrote that. And then he called me up. And it was just like, why did you write that? I go, Kevin did a promo. I figured it out. No one told me. And he just goes, oh, he was so mad that, like, you know, like.
What was the promo Kevin did?
It was just like, I don't even remember what it was, but I could tell from the promo that, you know, it was a pro wrestling promo.
Talking on about this character.
You know, just talking about Brian, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, well, if it's a shoot, you're not going to do a promo on it. And everything.
Yeah, I gotcha.
And then it led to the match with the I Respect You Booker Man. It was just, again, it was a way, it was like the loser had to say, I respect you or something. And it was just a way to, you know, to get over and to get people talking about the character. Yeah.
Was that something that was that just on the cuff, or was that something that was planned to call him?
No. Well, I don't know. Booker Man, that I don't know.
Yeah, gotcha.
But I mean, that was worked out with him and Kevin, yeah.
Because Booker Man was like, at the time, did you hear the word Booker?
Right. Because you're not supposed, because you never used that term in those
days.
That's
right, yeah. You never heard anything about that, for sure.
Right.
Wasn't he doing something too? Was he had like a 1-800 number, or he would be running through the crowd? Yeah. What was all that?
Okay, so this was during this period where I forget if he was like suspended or something, but he was off TV. But the idea was they would bring him to Nitro and he'd run around in the crowd with the, you know, call Brian 1-800, and people would call and he would insult him on the 800 number. And he made, like, the first couple of weeks he made a lot of money off of it too. But then, you know, it dwindled down. But the thing on that one was, so he's in the crowd doing that, and he's supposed to be suspended because, you know, he was a loose cannon, and Eric and Kevin wanted him off TV. And he was, the idea is he's sneaking into the arena, and like he would go on, and then Eric would make these remarks on TV like, oh, this guy going for attention, you know, like trying to act like it's not part of the show. Mm. And then Hogan saw it, and they were doing that 2-on-8 horrible freaking cage monstrosity match. Yeah. And Hogan saw how over Brian was and goes, I got to get Brian in this match. And I mean, it was so bad because it was like, the finish was going to be Hogan pinning Brian with a freaking leg drop. And Brian was just like, this is like, he didn't want to be back. He thought it was way too soon to come back. And the deal was he wasn't going to come back for a while. But Hogan said, like, you've got, you know, this main event. I want Brian in this main event. I want him in this main event. He's so over. So they tell him. So Brian goes in there. And Brian, from when he was born, had like polyps in his throat, and every so many years would need surgery. He nearly died when he was 2 and nearly died when he was 4 from the cancer, you know, as a child.
Like throat cancer?
Throat cancer, yeah. That's why he had that voice.
Right.
So he, to avoid this, I mean, he was going to need like a surgery at some point that year, 18 months, right? So he created this thing where it's like, I need surgery that month, right before the thing. And he told Kevin Sullivan. And Kevin is just like furious because he's supposed to be in the main event. And Hogan wants to beat him so bad. And Pillman's just like, this is my surgery. And Kevin knew enough, I guess, to know that Brian was very conveniently scheduling this, which was the truth, although Brian didn't tell him that. And so he was like really mad, but it was like, what can you do? Mm-hmm. I mean, he really did need the surgery at some point. So he was recovering from the surgery and never did the match.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a great way to get out of it, right?
I know. Well, believe me, he wanted out of that match. That match was like one of the worst matches in history, but he was the one, before that match even happened, he told me this, you know, because it was like Zeus and Jeep Swenson and all of these characters, you know.
Booty Man, I think, was in there.
Yeah, it's Hogan and Randy against 8 guys, and Hogan and Randy were going to run through all 8. And it was just like, this was something like, this is going to be like the absolute worst thing for my character possible, is to be the guy who gets pinned at the end,
yeah,
you know, in that situation, and to be in like, we, you know, he just goes, this is going to be the worst match in history. And it really almost was. It was so bad.
And also, I love the fact that Hogan, he's so over one in the match just so I can beat him.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So how did he end up, and you touched on it before, but let's go through how he was able to get this release from Bischoff. Is that why he was in ECW at that point in time?
ECW was a thing, because ECW and WCW, everyone knew they hated each other. Mm-hmm. So Sullivan and Paul were friends, you know, and I don't know all of the machinations, but Brian was talking to me about the whole thing. He just goes, you know, that, you know, Paul was always like, you know, they're the enemy. And Paul and Brian liked each other for, you know, from the past, I guess from when they were in WCW together, right. They really liked each other. And the thing was, is like, Brian's belief was, everyone knows that WCW would never let somebody go to ECW. Mm-hmm. So for me to go to ECW proves that I'm really not in WCW and I'm really out of there. Because the whole idea was to work people, that he was like fired from WCW and then he would come back. And so that was the whole ECW thing, was to buy him like 6 months of, you know, just not being in WCW, where people go like, he's in ECW. There's no way he's in WCW. But they were in some form all working together behind the scenes, Kevin and Paul. Like, okay, this one time, you know, we'll all do each other a favor. And Paul loved the idea because Brian gave him all kinds of publicity for ECW and was doing like the best promos of his career at that point. And the crazy stuff, like where he wrestled the pencil in Elliot Pollock's living room and just all
what
these
did he
things.
Do?
That, was right after the Kevin Sullivan Booker thing. Yeah. So it was just like he had this giant pencil and he was doing this match in somebody's thing where they filmed for an ECW promo, where he's like, you know, the pencil's throwing him around and he's throwing the pencil around and he's just going like, you know, it's a metaphor for Kevin Sullivan.
Right. The Booker Man. Yeah. The pencil.
Yeah. The pencil. Yeah, exactly. The pencil.
he had my first match in the arena against Taz, and Taz, the finish was Taz suplexing on my head. Which he did, and then I get stretchered out or something, and then Pillman runs in the ring and does the classic like Ron Ritchie baby face where he's slapping the mat and come on, like, you know, just literally jumping up and down, slapping the mat, come on. Then Taz takes a step towards him, Pillman jumps out of the ring, jumps into the crowd, into the arms of a guy who played for the Philadelphia Eagles, this guy called Harry Boatswain, and the guy carried him out of the crowd back to the dressing room. And I just remember, like, you know, once again, like, just this weird wacky stuff, but he was super over because he played it so good, because he really thought he was off his head.
Yeah, and remember, like, he like got people thinking he was going to pull his pants down and pull his thing out on
he was going to pull his Johnson and piss all over the ring. Yeah.
Right.
And if it was going to happen, it would be an ECW.
Yeah,
at the time, right?
Yeah.
So when he was talking to Bischoff and Sullivan about getting his release, like, how you think about it now, and how would Bischoff ever buy that? Like, how did
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's like, it's funny because I think he told me like right after it happened, you know, like he didn't tell me before, and he just goes, I just got my release. And so, you know, whatever. And it's like, no, I got my release. I'm going to start negotiating with Vince. 'Cause that's when we were talking about, like, you know, negotiating with Vince and playing both sides and everything. But, you know, the thing that he sold them on is like the only way, like, that people are going to believe this is real is we got to go all the way with it. It's like, you got to give me a real release to fool the office workers, because the office workers are going to tell someone that, oh, he's not really released. Mm-hmm. He's still getting paid, blah, blah, blah. So it's like, we've got to do this like totally legal. So it's like, when they did it, they thought that it was just part of the angle. And, you know, we're doing this fake thing, but they did it on legal, you know, they did it like on stationary and everything like that. But they thought, hey, look, you know, we're all working this angle together. And then, like, as soon as he's got that release, then he starts talking to WWE with Jim Ross. And they're like, you know, you're not really released. And he goes, I got this legal release. Hmm. You know, so I mean.
What was the end game with Bischoff? Okay, you release me.
Yeah.
Then I'll go.
The idea was, is then eventually he's going to come back. And, I mean, the goal always was to come back.
To show up on Nitro and do whatever. But maybe this guy does not work here.
Right.
He does not work here, sort of thing.
Yeah. And I think that they like being the only guys, quote, in on the angle that's fooling everyone in wrestling, the boys, no one knows. And we're really, you know, it's like, you know, even if it's not necessarily drawing money at the time, there's that satisfaction of, like, you know, we're fooling everyone type thing that they were getting, because it really was getting a ton of attention.
Well, sure. And also, too, WCW were big on working the boys.
Right, right.
They really liked that.
But I think this was like the catalyst of all of it. This may have been the first time they really did it, because then they started doing it a lot and it got, you know, it kind of got pathetic.
Yeah.
Especially because, you know, you were there. So you know what I mean? It's like, at one point, maybe the first time you're going like, this is pretty cool. And then after a while, it's like, you know.
Sullivan and Ben were getting in a fight in a bar with 10 of the boys are there and that's it.
Yeah.
And they're fighting each other.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, I could tell from Benoit sold one punch a little bit like a sell. And I was like, that's a work. But why us? Like, then you think about it.
And nobody was there, because I remember that story.
Yeah, no one was there. Just me and a couple other dudes. And the thing was, this is not like 2016. It's 1996. There's no internet, really.
Just barely.
Just barely. There's no Twitter. There's no Facebook. There's nowhere to even tell people I saw this happening.
Right.
You know, it was just a word of mouth amongst your friends. So who are you really working? You know?
Yeah. It was strange. Plus, it just got really bad, too, because it's like, you know, to me, it's like you really want to have some, because it's a paranoid business anyway.
Yeah.
And you just want, you know, you want to have the talent trust management as much as possible. Because when, you know, when you were there, I mean, you had to sit there and just go, like, no matter what was said, even if it's true, you're going like, okay, what's the angle? What's going on?
Is this real? Is it a work?
Yeah.
Like you said, even if it's true, even if 99% of everything you hear is true, because they tried to work at one time, you never believe anything.
Right.
So it just causes huge unrest amongst everybody.
Yeah, I remember in that situation because all the guys were just like paranoid of everything in WWE. I mean, more than in other companies.
Sure, more than ever.
Yeah.
So when Brian gets his release and then he goes to Vince, did they sign him right away? Was there some negotiation?
No, they were negotiating back and forth, and he was like really happy, but Brian was spiraling into like the painkillers and the whole bit, and it was pretty bad, like, you know, wrecking cars and stuff. So he got in a Humvee wreck that like was horrible. He was thrown like I don't remember the number, but he was thrown really far, and I know that his face was totally unrecognizable. His ankle was destroyed, and because Melanie, you know, called me right away, and she was just freaking out. His wife. And then Kim Wood told me the same, that he visited him. He goes, "Oh my God, it's like you could not recognize him. That's how bad his face was messed up from the wreck." And I mean, he really should have died right there.
Hmm.
But he was, you know, they found him, and they saved his life. But his ankle was completely destroyed. So I don't know what he thought or knew. He told me. I mean, I know he told me, and this wasn't true, because later he admitted it was that. The doctor said after the surgery, I'll be okay. You know, it's like, it's going to be I'm going to be messed up for a while, but I'll be okay. But the whole thing was, is he had these two companies and they're both bidding for him. And he was really a hot commodity at the time. And then he got in this very legitimate wreck and he didn't know if he was ever going to be able to wrestle again.
Hmm.
And he should have never wrestled again.
Because they had to fuse his ankle into walking position.
That was the second operation months later.
Oh, wow.
The first one, and then the first one didn't take very well. So he had to have a second operation where they rebroke the ankle, and then they fused it. So he had to, so his ankle was fused, and he's trying to wrestle on that fused ankle, and he's trying to get through airports, and he was just, but the Humvee wreck like changed everything, because the mentality was always to go back to WCW. I mean, it always was,
really?
Whether it's the Horseman thing or whatever. Because we discussed this a lot, and it was always me arguing, look, Shawn Michaels is their world champion. WCW, they've got all those top guys. They're never going to move, you know, like, but you can work with Shawn. You're the same size as him. You're a good athlete. Your character's over. You could be like that guy. And it was like, but WCW was given guaranteed money, and he thought he would make more money in WCW. He wanted, you know, the Luger money, right? And so it was always there. But what ended up making the decision is that Vince gave him a guaranteed contract. And Eric gave him a guaranteed contract, but it had 90-day cycles where that they, even though it's like a, you know, you had the same contract where, you know, they could fire you in 90 days. And his thing was, if I can't, with the Vince thing, it was like guaranteed for 3 years. But with the Bischoff contract, it's like I could be fired in 90 days if I can't wrestle. And Eric wouldn't like not do the 90 days. Like, and that was the difference. It was like, I think that Eric's money might have been slightly better than Vince's, although they were in the same ballpark. But the thing was, it's like, for my family, I have to go there. The
thing is, and Eric and Vince both know about this accident, obviously.
Yeah, well, that's the thing.
They both know that he's damaged.
But they were still interested in him, because I don't think that they realized. But I mean, the thing was serious. And that may have been why Eric wouldn't remove the 90-day cycles, was because of that very thing. But, you know, he was telling everyone, I'll be fine. Mm-hmm. And I'll be ready to go.
And it was a different world back then, too, though. You didn't have to get cleared. Like now, the WWE doctors have to clear you. There's a whole medical staff.
At that point in time, there wasn't even a
trainer. You had to throw your own black tape in the bag if you wanted to tape your wrists up and bring your own baby oil.
Yeah.
So he might have been able to say, doctor says I'm going to be okay. And they go, all right.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, even from the beginning, he didn't know. And then after a while, he did know that, because I think they told him he should never wrestle again. But, you know, he was, you know, he did.
Man.
And it probably, like I said, he probably shouldn't. I mean, I was, you know, he would play softball during the off thing. You know, when he was working for WWE, he had this loose cannon softball team that he played.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, he couldn't play the field. You know what I mean? He was only, designated hitter. And he had a hard time running when he would hit the ball. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like, when I heard that he couldn't play the field, it's like, oh, my God. And then people would tell me, oh, my God, you know how much pain Brian is going through the airports every day.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start hearing about, you know, his spiraling downward.
That's why he's taking all these painkillers.
Right, 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 exactly. And I remember that, like, they were kind of like going like, you know, maybe we'll make you a, you know, a TV announcer, because he probably could do real well at this. And Brian was just like, oh, you know, like, he wanted to be a wrestler, and he was so paranoid. Like, he came back too quick, because I remember the whole thing is like, he felt because they were paying him a guaranteed salary that he needed to wrestle every night. That was just the mentality of him. Like, it's not like be on TV and not wrestle and do vignettes and things like that. You know, it was like, now you could do that, right?
Right.
But then his mentality was, is the only way you're making money for the company is you're going out on the road and you're doing that. So it was like, he didn't want to be making money that he wasn't earning. I mean, we would, I don't say argue is not the right word, but he would talk to me about that. And it was just like, you don't need to rush back. And it's like, I've got to earn my keep, or however he would use that phrase.
Because at the time too, offering him a guaranteed contract, there was not a lot of guaranteed contracts in 1996.
This is 96. Well, in WWE, he was, I don't think he was the first, but he was in that first line.
One of the only ones. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There were only a few. So, you know, I don't think he wanted the resentment of...
Well, there you go. And the boys find out about it. And then this guy's not even working and he's making more than me. And
right.
Then you get all that problem too.
Right, right. So, you know, you got like all of that going on. So it was like he was adamant about working and there was so little he could do. He had to, you know, like, just think of it from your situation, because you relate to this as the same type of a wrestler in the sense of, okay, you're a really good wrestler, really, really good. You can do all this. And let's just say you got in this, you know, really bad injury. And mentally, you know everything that you know.
Right.
You know everything that you know. But physically, you cannot do like 70% of what you do in the ring. And it's, but you still want to do it. And you're not 45. Let's say you're 30, 34-ish, right? And, you know, and you've got five kids too. So that's, you know, you could probably relate to like what he's going through.
And
at that
also
point
too, it's not like he'd been there for years.
No.
And could get by on his personality. He's the new guy on the block.
Right.
He has to impress people and he can't do what he usually does.
Right, right. You know? So it was, that was a real tough time.
Did he have any good matches in WWE? I remember him being there and it's like he always had something going on, but an actual good match.
I think he did, because I remember like there was one, and I mean I can't remember.
Yeah.
There's nothing like his matches with Ric Flair or like with
Liger,
Eddie Guerrero,
Eddie
or something. Yeah. But I do remember on occasion like he would take like bumps on his face all the time on steps and stuff, and did things that, I mean, it did work. I mean, you could see he was limited, but most of the matches I don't think were that good. But he, on occasion, I think he had a good match.
Did he come in with some pretty good fanfare into the WWE? I remember he had a press conference.
Yeah, yeah, no, they brought him in like you know, because remember, this is the middle of the ratings war and they're losing.
Mm-hmm.
So they thought, you know, they brought him in to be this guy to turn the ratings around. And, you know, because everyone behind the scenes is talking about him, they
right.
thought that he would. And, you know, no one guy at that point in time was going to turn the ratings around yet. I mean, I guess Austin to an extent did later, but
at the time, though.
Yeah. But at the time, I mean, I know, you know, because that's the other thing is like Tuesdays, he would call me, not every Tuesday, but if he was featured on a Tuesday, I mean, on Monday night, he would call me and, you know, quarter hour, everything.
He was
a total student. And I mean, the one thing, you remember the gun angle with Steve?
Right, I want to talk about that.
Okay,
yeah.
So the gun angle with Steve, him and Steve both, the next day, you know, because it really didn't do that well in the ratings, and they thought, like, this was going to be the big turnaround. And I mean, it was just interesting how, like, I mean, I would get these breakdowns of, like, every demo and everything, you know, like, on how, and how the minute by minute and quarters were going. And like Brian was like such a student of all this. And it was like older women, like really stuck with the angle, but everybody else was going back to in the angle was going back to Nitro. And it, you know what I mean? And I know that they were like, I think they were both really sort of disappointed because it was kind of like, and Vince probably was as well. And then Vince had to apologize over the angle because the network got heat, which is hilarious when you talk about like 1996 to 2006, because you could do that now and people would go out, you know, some people would go, it's a dumb angle because of a gun, but there'd be no heat over it. It's just wrestling. But then wrestling was, I guess the idea was it was portrayed as real enough that like using a, you know, a gun, pulling out a gun in the middle of a show was like, Vince had to apologize on TV the next week.
Well, let's talk about the angle. What exactly happened?
So Brian's, you know, this is when he's injured and Steve's character is really getting over. And Brian and Steve were playing off the fact that they were friends. But God, I'm trying to remember how the whole thing was.
They were feuding with each other at the time.
basically, weren't they?
Kind of. It was like, it was acknowledged that they were, had a past, okay. I think, in a weird way. And I just remember there was something where they set up a Bret Hart and Austin match, which was in the Madison Square Garden match in 96. And Brian is like cheering like this behind Austin's back, and like Austin sort of sees it. So it's kind of like, that was like the little look. And for whatever reason, I don't even remember what happened, but they set up this thing where Austin was going to go to Brian's house and beat him up.
Yeah, he's going to break into his house. Yeah.
Right. And it was his real house that they did it in. And, you know, Brian gets all these bodyguards because he can't defend himself because he's pretty, you know, pretty much messed up from the ankle. And Steve comes in and Brian's got the gun. And then they come in there and there's this big to-do and these his security guys are being beaten up by Austin, and then you hear the gunshot, and then the feed goes out for like a long time.
Yeah, Brian's pointing the gun,
right?
And then the gunshot, and then it goes black, right?
And then it goes black, and then they, you know, came back, and I forgot, you know, whatever. But yeah,
so people are so outraged at this, thinking that Pillman shot Austin.
I think so. I think for a little while, but it didn't get over as big as I mean, you know, it's a competitive Monday Night War thing. But it was a groundbreaking thing, and it was also the first night Raw had just changed its time slot. So Vince wanted something really big to establish the new time slot. Like, oh my God, you know, I think they started an hour earlier than before, and it was one of those things where look what you missed, right? So it was like they wanted, you know, that's why Vince probably greenlit it. It was because he felt he needed something huge that week,
mm-hmm.
And Austin was really hot at the time, and Brian was, you know, it may have even been Brian's idea for all I know. But
wow. So afterwards, Vince had to apologize to the fans, to the Gun Association of America?
USA Network.
Wow.
Told Vince he had to apologize. So he went on TV and just said something like, you know, we're never going to use a gun again or something like that. But yeah, right on the air. You know, could you imagine that could never happen today?
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
But I mean, even that's a pretty crazy thing, though. Like, they would not have a gun on Raw now.
No, and you wouldn't even have it now either.
You wouldn't. There's no real reason to. The fact they even went there, I mean, also it was the Attitude Era, but that's pretty heavy stuff. Like on wrestling, gun.
But they're in the middle of a war that they're losing. Yeah,
right, you know, right.
Like just as an example, like people will ask about different things that happened in that era. Like, why would Vince do that? And it was like, because he was losing. And it was like, if Vince was winning, you know, WCW didn't do it. When WCW was losing, then they got desperate.
Right.
You know, they started doing really weird things.
Try for the shock value.
Yeah, because you're just like, how do we get back in this game, mm-hmm. that we're losing?
What was the – did you ever hear any kind of – I mean, I know for my own self, when I first got to WWE, and after a couple months, Vince took me in his office and read me the riot act about how, you know, I wasn't worth the contract that was printed on. I was green as grass, and he was sold a bill of goods.
Oh my God. You know,
it was pretty bad. Did that ever happen with Pillman at all, even behind the scenes? Were they ever disappointed, like, oh, this guy can't do anything like we thought he could?
I never heard that.
Okay.
I mean, you know, behind the scenes because he was hurt.
Yeah.
But he really was a pretty good performer in that aspect.
Right.
And people did, like, even when he was not having great wrestling matches, people were talking a lot about him. I think there may have been, like, a thing behind the scenes with Vince that, like, you know, we thought his ankle was going to be 100%, mm-hmm. and that, but in the other aspects of the game, he really was very good. And I think that if there was a disappointment, it was because he was just so whacked out and they were just really scared,
mm-hmm.
you know, of what might happen to him. And, cause it's not like, you know, you could feel it coming. You know, you really, it's not like some deaths where it's like out of the blue and you're just like,
there's so many things happening, little things that you could tell things were.
Yeah. You know, like just, you know, again, like wrecked rent-a-car this weekend type of thing. And then a couple of weekends later, wrecked rent-a-car. You know, and he always had a story as why. But, you know, and then there was like, there's so much stuff that happened. Like, there was a time, which is not a wrestling story. So he had a girlfriend named Rochelle from before he was married, who, you know, he was probably with for years and years. And they had a kid together. And so she just took off. She had her own problems, and she just took off. And they'd already split up by this point. I think Brian may have even been married by this point.
Mm-hmm.
But she took off, and she's gone, and no one can find her in Cincinnati. And so Brian, just like, you know, she was supposed to pick up the daughter, and she never came. Like, nobody can find her. And Brian just goes, like, my name's going to be all over the news. They're going to think I'm the new OJ. And he goes, I swear to you, just before, no news had come out yet. He goes, she's gone. Nobody can find her. like everyone knows we had the relationship. It ended bad. And it's like, I'm going to be the new OJ in the city. It's going to come out. And he was so scared. And it was like a 2-week thing. And I don't remember if it ever got any pub, but he went to wherever like the big drug section in Cincinnati was. And he went down like asking questions, you know, trying to find out where is she. You know, she didn't come to pick up her daughter. And they're going to come looking for me because I'm going to be the number one suspect. So he ends up getting arrested down there, you know, because and he's got his pain pills on him with, and he doesn't have his prescription with him. So, you know, and he's and this is going to make this made news because he's something of a celebrity, played on the Bengals and everything. And he was a star wrestler. And so so that was like another thing in the sense that, you know, here he got arrested there. And then, you know, she finally turns up when she's in a car with some guys and, you know, somewhere in Florida. You know, she went down to Florida with some guys and they got pulled over and she's in the car. And that's when like the missing person thing happened. But until then, I mean, you know, she's a missing person. She's gone for 2 weeks. No one has any whereabouts of her. And the police are asking him questions. Mm-hmm. And
another thing, right?
And this
did she end up committing suicide or something?
She committed suicide on the phone with her mom. I think she wanted to kill herself on the phone with Brian, but Brian was on the road. So, and Brian and her mom were really tight.
Jeez, man.
So she kills herself, shoots herself in the head on the phone with her mom. And Brian has this incredible guilt trip because of what the mom had to, you know, can you imagine the mom? And he loved that mom.
Right.
So, yeah. And this is all like probably 96. This is all at the 96, 97. This is all going on all at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about when he finally passed away, because he passed away. A lot of this is similar to the way Eddie passed away.
Very similar. Like, yeah, the day before a big show.
The day of a big show or something like that.
Right. It was the day of a pay-per-view. So he was in. He worked in Minneapolis the night before, and he went to bed at 10:45, or he went to his room at 10:45. And, I mean, he left his wife a message. And, you know, the next day there's a pay-per-view, and Brett and Brian aren't there. And this is like 2 hours before the pay-per-view starts. So there's kind of like the thought, well, Brett and Brian are, you know, they weren't like best of friends, but they were friends. And
they did the Hart Foundation thing. That was a pretty successful angle that they had there.
So, and you know, Brett's rep was that he was always late for everything.
Right.
So it wasn't really that concerning at first because it's like, well, Brett's not here and Brian's probably with Brett.
Mm-hmm.
But then Brett walks in and there's no Brian and he hasn't been with Brian. And then they're going like, you know, where is it? Whatever. And so they call the hotel, and I guess the hotel had just opened the door in the room and he was dead.
Hmm.
So Vince goes on the pregame show. This is how you just imagine. I'm just watching the pregame show before pay-per-view, not thinking anything. And Vince breaks in with this thing of, you know, Brian Pillman died. And I was just like,
oh, wow.
You know, and so the first thing I do is call his wife and she's just freaking. And I was just freaking. And I'm sure everybody's freaking. The one thing I remember about that show is like nobody had a good match except Shawn and Undertaker had one of the greatest. It was the first Hell in a Cell. Mm. And they had like really one of the greatest cage matches in history that night. And I just watched, I'm like kind of in this hazy blur, like not really being able to enjoy the match, mm-hmm. going like, God, I think this is like the best cage match I've ever seen in my life, I think. Because I had to watch it later, 2 days later.
You can't really pay attention.
Yeah, and it's just like, and it was really Shawn. I mean, not that Undertaker wasn't.
Yeah, you know, it was Shawn at his peak.
But Shawn was just incredible. It's like,
how? Wasn't that the debut of Kane as well?
That was the night Kane debuted, yeah. And I'm just thinking like, how can Shawn do a match like this on this day when nobody else can even work? Mm-hmm. And I was just like, you know, Shawn was one of the greatest of all time anyway. But it was like, I was just like, wow. But you know, Vince, and I know they never told the people in the building, and Vince didn't know. From what I gather, he was going back and forth. Should I even go on the air with her or wait until like the next day, let the pay-per-view go? But he made the call to say it on the pregame show, and I think they mentioned it once or twice on the air. And
was he supposed to have a match that night?
There was something where he was, they were doing a thing where Terry Runnels was Marlena.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was doing the thing where he had Marlena before Goldust did. And they were going to do a program where he won the services of Marlena. And then Marlena was going to leave Goldust for him in the storyline, you know, after the 30 days were up and stay with him. And send him and Goldust were going to do the big program.
The Triple X Files, I remember, that's what it's called.
Right.
Brian Pillman's Triple X Files. Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, he was a key part of that pay-per-view. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, they had dropped the angle cold and all that. But yeah,
it's amazing to think about that. Like you said, it's almost 20 years ago, and the fact that happened
a few other times right afterwards. You're talking about the Owen Hart incident was right before this?
No, it was 99, so it was a couple years, later.
It was Owen Hart. Eddie's thing, is, so it's not around the same time, but it seems like such a long time ago, but it was very much the first time that somebody had actually passed away before a show that they actually had announced it, and then they had to do it again with Eddie, had to do it again with Owen, had to do it again with Benoit. It was just a, kind of this rash of guys.
Yeah, and that may have been the first one. I don't remember if they brought everyone on stage or not, but I think that they did.
Wasn't there some kind of controversy afterwards with Melanie and
yeah, she was so Melanie talks to Vince. Vincent is talking to Melanie, and Melanie's just like, she wants to like give this message of, guys, you know, like don't do the pills, you know what I mean? Don't let the business kill you, type of a thing. And so Vince like wants to put her on the air, but it was a real bad situation. It was very awkward. But they put her on the air on and they're
live. Brian Pillman's widow, yeah.
Right. Vince is when he was sole TV announcer. He's interviewing Melanie, and they built it up throughout the entire show like it's a ratings thing, and it kind of like felt like it was, mm-hmm. which made it bad. And then just the chemistry between the two of them, she wasn't ready to be on the air, and Vince asked, like, you know, like Vince goes like, well, how are you going to support yourself, which probably like to a wrestling fan watching is not, you know. And then she doesn't have really an answer, and it just was very awkward and bad. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, I just, like, people were furious at it, and I was just like, look, the guy just died. Nobody's judgment's the best right now. Yeah. Like, I wasn't mad at Vince over it, but a lot of people were.
Did he kind of, when somebody passes away like that, do they pay out the contract, or how does that work?
I think that Vince paid out the contract. Mm. I think, maybe not for the whole 3 years. I mean, I don't remember. She definitely got money, and they did like a fundraising magazine for him and everything. And there were times where, like, you know, Vince did loan her money, which I'm sure, you know, he never got back. You know, like down the line. I mean, I know Vince, he was better than most bosses, I think, would be. But, you know.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm sure that there's the, you know, whatever. I mean, I don't know the whole story there. And then Les Thatcher would do the benefit shows.
I did one of those.
Right, right. Yeah, and I went to a couple of them and everything like that for a couple of years until, you know, it became a mess, unfortunately.
Right, right, right. As those things usually always do, the more the years go by.
Right.
So this is kind of a retro, but do you miss talking to Brian?
Yeah, you know what? I mean, like, you know, like, it's, again, it's 19 years, so you don't think about it as much now. But, like, you know, literally, what is it, 5 weeks after he dies is the Survivor Series thing, you know, with Brett and everything.
Oh, right.
So at that point, you know, number one means Brian. But Brian was one of those guys that, like, whatever was going on in WWE, when he would, like, when we would talk about it, Brian had, like, this take that was always, you know, he's a really funny guy. It was always, like, hilarious. Like, he would tell the story, and it wasn't even embellished, but the way he would tell a story would be, like, just hilarious. And, you know, like, I mean, I remember, like, once when he first went to WWE, and he's telling me the thing about China and Triple H. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, you know, like their relationship was like, this is the point where nobody knew they had a relationship.
Right.
Okay. But they were together on screen. And Brian is like telling me this. And he's telling me this like in this way where like you don't know if he's like completely pulling your leg. And but it's like this hilarious story about like they went into the room together and go, so what? They work together. He goes, no, you don't understand. And I go, yeah, you're paranoid. You know, like that. But he goes, no, I'm not, you know, and I'm thinking he's just completely pulling my leg on this one, right? But he would, but I, when that happened and everything was like that hit me because it was just like Brian watching this story unfold. And then whenever like there would be another weird story that would go on in wrestling, that's when I would miss him because he would like have this just like completely all over the top reaction that would be just hilarious to cut through like all the bullshit of everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I would miss him when something big, really big would happen in wrestling that was kind of confusing and everything, and Brian would just make it into some, you know, ridiculous comedy.
Right, right, right. The Pillman way of doing things. What is there a match of his, last question for you, is there a match of his that stands out for you as being as your favorite?
I think probably the Liger match on the Super Brawl pay-per-view would be my favorite in Milwaukee. You know, because he had, that was kind of like for him too when he started like in Calgary and everything. I mean, those were the guys he watched the tapes of, and Yamada was there in Calgary too, you know, before he became Jushin Liger.
Right.
And then he'd become a really big star in Japan at that point. and then they were bringing him in to the United States. And again, the people in WCW didn't really, like, he was hot and people talked about him, Liger were talking about, but they didn't really know how to get him over or anything. So it was kind of like, we'll put him with Brian, and they worked like a string of house show matches that were just blowing people away, and that was the pay-per-view match. Mm-hmm. But Brian was like showcase, you know, like 17 minutes of, like, you know what I mean? Like, you know, when you're there and they're going, you can work with somebody really good and you got 6.5 minutes,
yeah,
or four minutes or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, this was like, he had the time and it was like the dream opponent, like the one of the best guys in the world. And it was on pay-per-view. So that was...
Didn't they also have the first match ever in Nitro history? Wasn't it Pillman and Liger?
Yes, it was the first match in Nitro history.
In Minneapolis, right?
In Minneapolis, the Mall of America.
Which is where he passed away. In Minneapolis?
In Minneapolis at the Bloomington or something.
Which is also where Eddie passed away.
Eddie and Brian passed away in the same city. That was freaky when Eddie passed away because I thought about that right away. You know, it wasn't the same hotel, but it was like, yeah.
It's funny, a lot of similarities between when you're telling me about stuff, how Eddie would force himself to work even if he was hurt because he thought he had to, sing for his supper. And another one, too, is when you said that Brian, if he had a little bit of a gut for us, we wouldn't even notice. For him, he felt like a fatso. Eddie was like that as well. Yeah. A lot of similarities between those two guys.
Yeah, and just the whole perfectionist thing.
Yeah.
I think, you know, again, both wanting to be main eventers so bad and so good and you know, being held back. I mean, Eddie did get his run at the end.
Yeah.
But, you know, for years and years, you know, who was better than Eddie? But he was, you know, at that level.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. He was stuck there.
They never let him. I want to tell you real quick, the two things, which, because these were the two highlights of his career. One was when...
Tell about Brian?
Brian. When Brian was in the Horseman, he just gotten in the Horseman and Sting was in the Horseman too, and they did the big turn on Sting, which is, it'd been done before.
Yeah.
But I remember Brian calling me up, and he was just like, that was real heat. That was real heat. It was like, you know, it's like, I got to go for the heat. And it's like, you know, he was in like a main event program with Sting and with Ric Flair, and he's standing there, and he's like a focal part of the thing. And he was so happy about, you know, finally being in that. He goes, this was the greatest night of my career. And the other one, which later superseded that as the greatest night of his career, was the Calgary Stampede pay-per-view.
I was going to mention that, yeah.
Okay. And Brian... When this is going on, okay, the whole thing where Brett's like a babyface in Canada and a heel in the United States. Right. So Brian's kind of with Brett and Owen, and they're all in this group. And Brian is just like, what is Brett thinking? Well, this is the stupidest thing. Because Brian wanted to be full hardcore heel all the way. And Brett wanted to be super heel in the United States, but still babyface in Canada. And Brian thought, you couldn't do it. Mm-hmm, you know, it's like, you know, this is, you know, what's Brett, you know, doing? He's got to go hardcore heel. And he was thinking like that. So Brian was like, just wanting to be heel. And so that night they have that match in Calgary. And of course, you know, Brian starred in Calgary. He was very fond of Calgary.
Sure.
In you know, in a lot of ways, knew the people there. And they were like super over his baby faces. And he called me up like right afterwards and said, this was the greatest night of my career. He goes, the crowd reaction, this and this and this. And he just goes, man, we were so wrong about Brett. Because I was agreeing with him, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, well, how can you be you know, on the same show? Because we were so wrong about Brett. Because this angle was so, like, going to be so huge with Austin. And, you know, I mean, he rode that angle. You know, he died in the middle of the angle, unfortunately.
Oh, it was still going on. He was still in the Hart Foundation?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I was at that pay-per-view at Calgary. I happened to have the day off.
Oh, really?
From WCW, and I went. I just remember how crazy the reaction was. Like, one of the greatest, killer, craziest reactions of any crowd I've ever seen.
Yeah.
You know, because they were so over the top with the Hart Foundation.
Right. And you know, again, it's like, even though they were like heels on television, I mean, they're, you know, Brett and Neidhart, I mean, Owen.
Yeah.
You know, Dave, I mean, they're you know, and Pillman, they're like the local guys. These people in Calgary watch them and they're star.
Yeah.
I mean, they were so loyal to them. And Brett was like a total superstar by this point in time. And then on the other side, you had, you know, Austin, who was just so freaking, you know, catching fire by this point.
Yeah, and Goldust was hot at the time. Shamrock was hot at the time.
Shamrock, was an Animal in there?
Road Warriors too. Yeah. So it was a real great mix. I'll never forget. I was going to mention that. If I just mention my favorite Pillman match, even though it wasn't technically great, just the atmosphere of it and his role in it too, because he was really good with the things that he did, would be that one. So.
Yeah. But that was absolutely his favorite night of his entire career.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I remember him. Yeah. He was just like... It was just like, that was, and I'm so glad he got it because, you know, again, he died on, was this in July?
Yeah. So
Stampede week, right? Wasn't it?
3-4 months later.
And, you know, he died in October.
Wow. Yeah. So that was, he finally got his Luger main event.
Yeah.
Thanks, Dave.
Okay.
That was cool remembering that.
And now
Reflections with Raven.
If you love someone, set them free. If they come back, they have Stockholm Syndrome, call the cops and have them arrested for stalking.
For more Reflections with Raven, listen to The Raven Effect on the Jericho Network via the Podcast One app or subscribe at Apple Podcasts. Raven and his co-host Busby will keep you laughing every Monday with the name game and their version of the news, quote unquote. And Raven's always got some great wrestling stories to throw into the mix. So subscribe to The Raven Effect at Apple Podcasts and be sure to leave them a 5-star rating and review. Subscribe to all the podcasts on the Jericho Network so you never miss an episode. Team Tiger Awesome Show on Sunday mornings. Rock Talk with Mitch LaFon on Mondays. Killing the Town with Storm and Cyrus on Tuesdays. The flagship show. The Keeping It 100 with Conan every Thursday, and Beyond the Darkness, new episodes every single weekday. They're going to scare the pants off you. You can get in on their True Crime Tuesdays as well. Dave and Tim, the two guys behind Beyond the Darkness, are also doing a weekly True Crime Tuesday podcast, but you can only get that by signing up at patreon.com for just $5 a month. You'll get a new episode every single Tuesday, and the episodes are all commercial free. No commercials. So sign up now at patreon.com. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks to Dave Meltzer for coming back on Talk is Jericho to share his stories and memories about Brian Pillman. Always a great conversation with Dave, and always great hanging out with you guys. And thank you for listening, and thanks for supporting the great sponsors of Talk is Jericho, who enable me to do this show for you Sexy Beast listeners for free for twice a week, talking about Geico, talking about TrueCar. Thank you for listening. Keep listening for the 60-second AP News headlines coming up next. And speaking of coming up, next Wednesday, right here on Talk is Jericho, we got, these guys have been around following me for years. They just show up everywhere. They just showed up on Talk is Jericho. I'm talking about the Singh brothers, I'm talking about Gurv and Harv. They are, of course, the minions for Jinder Mahal, and they have been on the wrestling scene for years and years and years. Good couple dudes, and they're very, very cool to drive from Orlando to Tampa to do Talk is Jericho with me. They will be here on Wednesday. That's right. The Singh brothers are going to be here. In the meantime and in between time, stay hard, stay hungry. Peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy!
Listen to new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday on the Podcast One app or subscribe at Apple Podcasts or PodcastOne.com.
Okay, Kevin, for the grand prize of $1 million. What color is the White House?
I know this.
5 seconds.
Oh, switching to Geico could save you a bunch of money on car insurance?
Okay. Judges? That's true, Kevin. They'll allow it. Congratulations. You're a winner.
Woo! Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
It's your last chance to get great holiday savings at Guitar Center. Like a Yamaha F-335 acoustic guitar, just $99. Or get a Luna Soprano ukulele, only $49. Plus, the newest and hottest guitars, drums, keys, and more. Exclusive gear you can't get anywhere else. Special financing. Lessons for the beginner on your list. And gift cards, the perfect present for every musician. So hurry in and find your sound at Guitar Center.